The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Eugene G. Doherty presiding.
Good afternoon. This is the Fourth District Court calling case number 4-25-0269, Garman versus Raul. I'd ask, starting with counsel for plaintiff, that you please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chris Bendick for Jesse Garman.
And for the defendant.
Mary Labreck for the defendant's appellees on behalf of the state, the Illinois Attorney General, and the Director of the Illinois State Police.
All right, thank you. Just before we proceed, I want to make a disclosure. Sometimes judges get sued in ways that two lawyers would say, no, you can't sue a judge for that. That doesn't make any sense, but we sometimes do. When a judge gets sued, the attorney general gets assigned to represent them when they're sued in their individual capacity. I believe there is a suit pending up in Boone County that I've been named as one of a long cast list of folks. And I'm making that disclosure, but I have reviewed the relevant Supreme Court rules of ethics, and I don't see that that's a basis for my disqualification, but I wanted to disclose that for the parties.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Bendick, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors and counsel. My name again is Chris Bendick, and I represent Jesse Garman in the appeal from the circuit court granting the defendant's motion to dismiss Garman's motion for declaratory judgment. In 2018, the Illinois Supreme Court made it clear to individuals like Mr. Garman the two options they have in order to challenge their SORA requirements. One of the options was filing a motion for declaratory judgment. And in 2024, Garman filed such a motion and asked the circuit court to conclude that, as applied to Garman in his circumstances, his SORA requirements violated our state constitution and its proportionate penalties clause. Garman supported his motion with sufficient facts about the circumstances, along with legal reasoning as to why the circuit court should conclude that Garman's registration requirements were unconstitutional as applied to him. And in that motion, he asked for an evidentiary hearing. In response to the defendant's combined motion to dismiss Garman's pleading, the circuit court short-circuited the appropriate process here and granted the defendant's motion to dismiss on several Section 2615 grounds. The circuit court's ruling was an error where it was not clearly apparent that no set of facts could be proven that will entitle Garman to relief. And because the circuit court's ruling was an error, this court should reverse the circuit court's dismissal of Garman's motion for declaratory judgment. Remand the matter for further proceedings. As to the
Mr.
specific.
Bendick,
Yes,
may
sir.
I interrupt you to ask a question? Where this fell down, I believe, was on the determination that the regulations in question were not punitive. Even though this is an as-applied challenge, do you agree that they are either punitive in their scope or they are not? It doesn't matter, they're not punitive against one defendant and not against another.
So our argument at this stage is that the circuit court did not give the due deference to the arguments that are out there that this is in fact punishment. There's well-established, authority both out of this state. I know that there's been vacated
Agreed,
authority.
but my question is, the answer to that question is going to be the same from one defendant to the next, whether they are intended as punishment by the legislature. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your
Legislature
Honor.
didn't have
Yes,
your client in
yes,
mind when, okay.
yes, yes. And so turning back to the circuit court's ruling here in 2024, its opinion and subsequent order, the circuit court denied the defendant's combined motion on Section 2619 grounds, but granted it on several 2615 grounds. However, had the circuit court provided the proper deference, the circuit court should have denied the combined motion. As the first basis for its opinion, the circuit court found that it was valid the defendant's argument that Garman had not set forth any facts to support a claim that SORA is unconstitutional as applied to him. However, Garman's complaint unambiguously asserts why factually SORA is unconstitutional as applied to him. After explaining why the underlying reasoning of the now vacated Tedder opinion from the third district still applies and should be adopted by the circuit court, Garman asserted why Sora's requirements are disproportionate to his crime and therefore unconstitutional. For example, Garman relied on his affidavit detailing the circumstances of a 1992 misdemeanor criminal sexual abuse case and why those circumstances demonstrate the disproportionality of his Sora requirements. Those allegations should have survived a 2615 motion to dismiss.
Can we look at another part of Tedder?
Yes.
Which is, as you know, no longer it no longer exists. But Tedder examined the question of whether these provisions are punitive. And Tedder applied the test of first ascertaining whether the legislature meant to establish civil proceedings. If it meant to impose punishment, then the second step is unnecessary. But if the legislature intended a civil regulatory scheme, then the next step is to determine whether the scheme is so punitive, either in purpose or effect, as to negate the intention to call it civil. That's the test that you think leads to the conclusion that these provisions are punitive, correct?
The Mendoza Martinez test, Your Honor, yes.
Well, that's the same test, albeit in the context of a different constitutional guarantee, but it's exactly the same test the Supreme Court came up with in COP, and it found that they were not punitive. So is that not foreclosed for us to disagree with that conclusion in the application of that test to these statutes?
So in regards to this case, because this is coming up to you on a 2615 grant, okay, there must be all deference to all the arguments made on our side, since we're the non-moving.
No, no, not to arguments. We assume the facts. We don't give deference to arguments.
Right.
And as we established at the beginning, this is an answer that is not particular to your client, whether these are punitive. The Supreme Court, applying the same test that you think we should apply, says they are not punitive. How is there even a factual issue for the trial court to avoid or to defer to?
So in this case, in COP, while the Illinois Supreme Court, when analyzing the ex post facto challenge there, found it not to be punishment. However, it did not analyze what, and as Your Honor referred to, the Tedder, now it's vacated, of course, but in that case, it relied upon the Sixth Circuit decision, the Snyder case.
Right.
And so the Snyder case is...
Here's where you have a problem. In the interpretation of the Illinois Proportionate Penalties Clause, the Sixth Circuit is like a law review article, right? The
right,
Illinois
it's persuasive.
Supreme Court is the top of the food chain, and it said not punitive.
In regards to the ex post facto challenge, correct, Your Honor.
But it, applying the same test at the front end as to deciding if it's punitive, the Supreme Court said these provisions are not punitive.
And the issue with the COP and its applicability to this case is that it did not analyze the arguments that were presented in Snyder, and in fact, what was discussed in obviously now the now vacated Tedder opinion, but it's still present in the dissent in Kochevar from 2020. Those arguments were not analyzed by the Illinois Supreme Court in COP. So we're putting the cart before the horse here, because there is a set of facts and law that, if applied to Garmin, would provide him for relief. That's why we're way beyond where we should be right now. The circuit court should not have granted this motion of dismission, should have denied it, should have heard all of these arguments. And then if it came to the conclusion that Your Honor's hinting at, then we'd be in a more difficult position here, I think.
But 615 is an appropriate place to make a conclusion of law. And, you know, based on uncontested facts or facts assumed, there are no facts that you've pointed to that would change the answer to the question of law.
Well, on the question of law, I do think that it's an open question based on those arguments that are clearly laid out in all the other authority, and as you say, persuasive. It is not binding. However, those arguments and that law is out there. And if district
In
court.
general, you will not see the appellate court tell the Supreme Court, well, your analysis wasn't quite right because you didn't think of some things that should have been considered. That's typically not in our quiver.
And in that situation, the appellate court or the circuit court, what they should say is, we recognize the cop opinion is out there. We don't recognize that that's in fact possibly controlling on us. However, we would adopt the reasoning that has been presented before. In fact, that's what happened in Tedder and Kochevar, because in Tedder and Kochevar, they thoroughly went through the prior Illinois Supreme Court authority on the subject, saying it's clearly punishment and not punishment by the prior authority. However, there's been changes to the statute and it makes it punishment now. And in fact, if that's what occurred here, that would be the argument to be adopted both by the circuit court and this court.
How is this case different in terms of punishment? How'd those changes in the statute make, as applied, in this situation, more of a punishment?
Well, and for two aspects, in general, as Justice Doherty, recognizes, there's the at large punishment for everyone, right? That this SORA requirement applies to everyone. And I think I'm not going to have the time or the knowledge to go through all of the stuff that is listed in Tedder and Kochevar and Snyder, but those cases go through the changes in the statute that when SORA was originally enacted to the 2011 amendments, and all of these new regulations that make it more of a punishment scheme. But in specific to Garmin, it's disproportionate based on his misdemeanor
You don't get to that
1995.
point unless it's punishment. So you
Correct.
want to go to the disproportionality, and you've got to first establish that what's disproportionate is punishment.
Right, Your Honor. I was trying to just answer Justice
Yeah.
Kavanaugh and his and it's a bifurcated analysis because, as you recognize, it has to be punishment first. And if we establish that, at least there's an argument that it's punishment, that as applied to Garmin, it's a disproportionate punishment based on the facts of his 1992 misdemeanor criminal sexual abuse, which was the result of a consensual boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. It was a misdemeanor crime back then. It's still a misdemeanor crime now. It was not registration eligible in 92. It became registration eligible in 2011 when the statute was changed and looped in a bunch of retroactivity stuff. But as to Garmin's facts, it is a disproportionate punishment to require him to register for 10 years in all the attendant circumstances that come with such a registration, that it's a disproportionate punishment. Should this court conclude that there is an argument that it is a punishment? Just to address two of the other bases for the, well, I think we've thoroughly discussed the punishment aspect of it, so I'll avoid any more of that unless Your Honor's having any questions as to that.
You agree, don't you, that Kopf, it was a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, and the Supreme Court decided that it didn't state a claim because it was not punitive. So 615 was an appropriate vehicle for that determination.
In Kopp, however, they also remanded the case for a further as-applied challenge to the statute, Your Honor, for an evidentiary hearing. So, in fact, it did not grant the 615 in full. And turning back to the other bases for the circuit court's ruling here, it said that the defendant's argument in favor of the continued requirement to register under SORA is valid, as argued in its memorandum in support of the defendant's combined motion to dismiss. But, of course, his 2020 felony conviction for, leaving his address for a few days did not cause Garmin to register. The registration occurred in 2012. That only extended his registration for 10 years post his release in 2022. So that was not a valid basis for granting the state's motion to dismiss. And as the plain language means that there's a singular case of registration, the circuit court erred there. I've We've discussed the punishment aspect of this, and as the reasoning of the cases that do establish that this is punishment and not a mere collateral consequence. The defendant's Section 2615 motion to dismiss should have denied on that basis.
Again, COPF did resolve and affirm the dismissal of the proportionate penalties, I'm sorry, the ex post facto claim on the basis that it was not punitive. What was remanded were other constitutional claims that didn't depend on that punitive predicate.
And again, those paragraphs 92 to I believe 112 of COP don't analyze any of the arguments that were adopted by Snyder, frankly. I don't know. Again, the AG's office might have further insight since they represented, the state in the COP matter as to the briefing, but I believe COP was a pro se litigant before the Illinois Supreme Court. I'm not sure what arguments. I could not determine that from my Westlaw research, what was in the briefs, if this was the Snyder arguments that were adopted by Tedder and Kochevar, if they were presented in full to the Illinois Supreme Court. But at least based on that existing case law, we believe that the 2615 motion was incorrectly granted here, and this court should remand further proceedings on Garmin's motion for declaratory judgment. If your honors have no further questions, we
Thank
ask
you. Thank you.
that relief from the briefs and reserve a remainder of our time in rebuttal if we need to.
All right, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Labrie, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. This court should uphold the dismissal of Garmin's action because he failed to state a claim for relief. As Your Honor noted, to state a claim for violation of his rights under the Proportionate Penalties Clause, a plaintiff must adequately allege two things: that the statute or statutes imposed punishment, and that the punishment imposed was disproportionate to the circumstances of this case. And as Your Honor also noted, the question of punishment is dispositive here because the Illinois Supreme Court's recent decision in COPF held that the current version of the SORA statutes does not impose punishment. Unlike the two cases that Garmin relies on, Tedder and Doe versus 125, COPF is binding on this court, and Garmin has no way to escape the scope of its ruling.
Is it binding because the Supreme Court was dealing with a different constitutional guarantee?
We do not think so. First of all, it makes sense as a matter of interpretation to construe the same words, punishment and penalty, the same way for purposes of these related provisions in the same constitutional text. And it seems that the case law agrees. For example, the cases that we cited on in our brief on page 15. Moreover, Garmin cites no authority suggesting that punishment means something different in these two contexts, nor does he suggest any reason and logic why this court should so construe it. And finally, and ironically, he urges this court to rely instead on Doe's 125 versus Snyder, and that decision is itself based on the ex post facto clause rather than the proportionate penalties clause. And he is mistaken in saying that the COPF decision is invalid because it didn't consider the arguments made in Snyder and Tedder. It is true that the court did not specifically address either the Snyder or Tedder decision, but it did discuss each of the Mendoza-Martinez factors applied in those cases and came to an opposite conclusion on each one. It specifically held, in contradiction of Tedder, that the SORA restrictions did not place an affirmative disability or restraint on offenders, did not resemble historical punishments such as public shaming, banishment, probation, or supervised release, were not intended as retribution, had a rational non-punitive purpose of protecting public safety, especially keeping children safe from predators, promoted that purpose through reasonable methods, and were not excessive in view of that purpose. Moreover, he doesn't point to any restriction that applies to him that Kopp did not consider. There is one statute mentioned in his complaint, and that was also mentioned in Tedder that was not mentioned in Kopp, which is the provision about name changes. But he is mistaken at the extent he argued in his complaint that it will prevent him from ever changing his name, because this is not true of the current statute. It only prevents offenders from changing their names during the periods they're required to register, and even then there are certain exceptions to the rule. Moreover, this does not allow Garmin to avoid Kopp, because he makes no argument about why addition of this statute should render Sora punitive. And even if it did, he does not explain why it affects him personally or why it rendered the penalty disproportionate. This court could end its analysis right here and affirm the circuit court's dismissal of this action because, as Your Honor had noted, there cannot be a proportional penalties violation if Sora is not punishment. But Garmin's arguments that the restrictions are disproportionate to his offense are equally flawed. He argues, in effect, that this case is just like Tedder, but there are significant differences, not least the facts that Garmin was placed on the registry for only 10 years instead of a lifetime, and that he had a greater opportunity to rehabilitate himself because the 10-year term did not start until he committed a subsequent felony. Thus, he could have avoided being placed on the registry at all by avoiding further violation of the law, whereas the defendant in Tedder was placed on the registry for a lifetime as soon as he committed his sexual offense. And even Garmin admits that his penalty was less disproportionate than the penalty in Tedder, so even if this court found Tedder persuasive, it would not follow that Garmin's lesser penalty was so disproportionate as to rise to the level of a constitutional violation. Now, Garmin also contends that the lesser severity that his offense was less severe than the offense in Tedder, but that is because he misunderstands the nature of the offense. The offense that is to be compared with the severity of the penalty in this case is the one that triggered his placement on the register. If placement on the register is analogized to a criminal penalty, then the actions that gave rise to that penalty correspond to the criminal offense. Accordingly, the offense in this case has two predicates and not one. Garmin's offense relative to Sora was not complete until he had two criminal convictions, his original sex offense and the subsequent felony. So both convictions must be considered part of his offense. And his subsequent felony conviction for aggravated domestic battery in 2012 was a Class 2 felony, just like Tedder's conviction for aggravated criminal sexual abuse. So Garmin's offense was necessarily more serious than Tedder's. Moreover, Garmin had none of the mitigating circumstances reported in Tedder. In fact, he had several aggravating circumstances. The defendant in Tedder was evaluated and found to be at virtually zero risk to reoffend. Garmin had no such evidence. And while an offender's judgment may mature over time, Garmin's extensive criminal record shows that his did not. Moreover, his record showed acts of violence like domestic battery and aggravated battery, and possibly including violence such as mob action and resisting arrest. He also had convictions for drug and weapons related charges. And he admitted at his 2012 sentencing hearing that he'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which represents an additional risk. Whereas Tedder had no prior criminal convictions apart from minor traffic violations and no underlying mental health or substance abuse concerns. Tedder also had the excuse of youth for his triggering offenses, whereas Garmin did not, at least not entirely. He committed his first offense at the callow age of 20, but he was about 40 when he committed his subsequent felony. Also, the court found that the defendant in Tedder believed his victim to be 18 when he first began having sex with her. But Garmin has never suggested that he did not know how old his victim was. And if he did, it is likely that the circuit court would not have believed him, given that he was living with the girl and her mother at the time. Now, leaving Tedder aside and evaluating Garmin's compound offense as an original matter, his argument fares no better. According to People v. Hilliard, a statute will violate the proportional penalties clause of the Illinois Constitution if it either imposes a penalty that is harsher than the penalty for an offense with identical penalties, I mean identical elements, or if the penalty is cruel, degrading, or so wholly disproportionate to the offense as to shock the moral sense of the community. Since Garman has identified no offense containing identical elements that is given a harsher penalty, this court must apply the latter test. It is satisfied primarily by reviewing the gravity of the defendant's offense in connection with the severity of the statutorily mandated sentence within our community's evolving standard of decency. And under this standard, it is equally clear that there was no constitutional violation. There is nothing especially harsh, degrading, cruel, or shocking about imposing a 10-year term on in the registry on Garman under the circumstances. His criminal record showed at the time that he was placed on the registry that he had often been either unable or unwilling to conform his conduct to the law over a period of many years, and that he could be violent with females to whom he had access. The aggravated domestic battery in 2012, for instance, was committed against a woman who was living with him. Now, to be sure, his criminal record does not suggest that he was the worst of the people that may possibly be covered by the statute. There is nothing to suggest that he was a serial predator who dedicated his time to cruising for minors. But it does suggest that the state was justified in keeping them away from him because he was likely to take advantage of the situation if he had access. There may be certain situations in which placement of offender on the registry for a youthful sexual offense and a subsequent felony would be disproportionate. But it is certainly not disproportionate as applied to Garman under the circumstances reflected here. And even Tedder seems to hint as much where it acknowledges that the restrictions imposed by the statutes may present fair and just punishment in many or most cases. And there is no question about whether the statutes accurately reflect concerns about recidivism. He argues that he had only one sex offense, but Sora takes the view that other crimes may reflect a general tendency to recidivate. It doesn't require that the subsequent felony be another sex offense, because other crimes may be like comorbidities in the sense that they help predict risk. And a statute cannot be deemed punishment on the ground that it isn't tailored enough toward its goals. It need only have a rational basis. And by the same token, this court cannot conclude that Garman is not dangerous for purposes of proportionality analysis just because he did not have a sex offense, second sex offense. We do not even know that he didn't commit one. We know only that he was not convicted for one.
Well, if we don't know that he was not convicted of them, I mean, that's true of all of us, right? We do.
Yes,
we
I'm not saying that we rely
convicted
upon that.
Of one.
I'm sorry.
It's a little bit of an overreach to say, well, you know what? He could have had another sex offense and just not been convicted of it. That's a little bit beyond the pale. That's true of anybody who walks into the courtroom, including the person with the judge with the robe. So it just doesn't it doesn't. It doesn't do your argument well to talk about uncharged crimes, unalleged crimes, as opposed to what's here on the record.
Your Honor, I didn't mean to suggest that that was a major part of that argument. I don't think we need it in light of every other argument that we've presented here. I was just mentioning that because he states as an affirmative thing, the evidence shows he did not commit a second offense. And I'm just saying we don't know that. But we
I
are.
Know, but the case was decided on a motion based on the facts it's pleaded, and that wasn't one of them.
Right. Well, okay. As I said, I don't think we need that. We need that argument for the reasons, based on the other arguments that we've made. So, if your honors have no further questions, I guess we will urge this court to affirm the circuit court's judgment dismissing Garman's action for failure to state a claim for relief.
All right, thank you. And to rebuttal with Mr. Bendick.
Just briefly, Your Honor, should this court conclude that, you know, that there is an argument to be made as to punishment, that Sora is punishment, it is, of course, disproportionate based on the facts that are pled in the motion for declaratory judgment toward Mr. Garman. If the state wants to argue about how Garman is a repeat sex offender without any evidence, they should do that in the circuit court, not before this court. But we've thoroughly gone through that in our reply brief that this is a disproportionate punishment based on a consensual relationship between an emerging adult and a teen that he was living with, 20 with a 16-year-old. This was a consensual relationship based on the facts in the motion for declaratory judgment. The state has assumed those facts, as Your Honor has identified. I can't contest it now in the appellate court. Place to do that is the circuit court. And of course, it should shock the moral sense of the community that a 20-year-old who had a consensual relationship with his girlfriend has to register for 10 years and all the attendant circumstances that come with such registration. It's ridiculous, frankly, if this court concludes its punishment is, and there's might be a circumstance where misdemeanor criminal sexual abuse is a valid proportionate punishment, but not in this case. Garman should not have to register if this court concludes that, at least arguably, and I know that's a criminal law term, arguable basis. First stage Hodges stuff, but there's an argument here that this is punishment. This court should remand the case for further proceedings on the motion for declaratory judgment. And with that, we rest on the arguments that were presented in our briefs. And thank you, Your Honors, for your time today.
And thank you to both counsel. Court will take the matter under advisement, issue a decision in due course, and we now stand in recess.
Thank you, Anders.
Thank you.